90.1. We are listener-supported, volunteer-operated. It's 3 o'clock and time for the Rift.
WEFT, you're here with me, celebrating a little music. We love to do these things, we love to have that fun. We love to do these things on WEFT. Who knows, this could be the new jingle for WEFT.
Repeat that.
Who knows, this could be new jingle for WEFT.
Straight freestyle.
WEFT. WEFT.
WEFT. WEFT. WEFT.
WEFT.
WEFT. WEFT. WEFT.
Prepared for, yeah.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts and the listeners of WEFT. April at Krannert Center features bassist and composer Stefan Crump with an Earth Day performance, Slowwater, on April 21st, and a street culture hip-hop circus by the 360 All-Stars on April 29th. Complete information on these and other performances is available at krannertcenter.com.
Who made a difference in your life? Give back to someone else by becoming a one-to-one mentor in Champaign-Urbana. All it takes to become a mentor is a desire to make a difference in the life of a child. It's fun, it's easy, and it is just 1 hour a week during the school day. Contact Lauren Smith in Champaign at 217-351-3722 or Angie Armstrong in Urbana at 217-337-0853 for information about how you can become a mentor. 1 in 3 young people are growing up without a mentor, someone outside of their family who they can turn to for support and guidance. Join over 500 local adults who are mentoring children in the Champaign-Urbana Public Schools through the One-to-One Mentor Program. For more information, check out our website at cu1to1.org.
Radio show about climate change, ecology, politics, and power. My name is Roshan Krishnan, and you're listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM here in East Central Illinois and streaming all over the world at weft.org. Today is Sunday, April 5th, 2026, and this is episode 29 of The Rift. We are living through what feels like it may be an inflection point in world history. In response to the United States and Israel's illegal aggression, Iran has shut down shipping through the Strait of Hormuz, effectively hamstringing the global oil economy. We're already seeing the effects on energy prices, and things are likely to get worse, being that the Trump administration has responded with threats to attack Iranian energy infrastructure. In many ways, much of what's happening feels like the death throes of Western hegemony, the end to American dominance of the world economy. And in a world where the West governs our approaches to climate change, disaster response, and whatever thin attempts at ecological planning exist across the globe, that feels like a big deal. This is jarring, of course, and portends potentially significant upheaval for people across the world, certainly here and already elsewhere in many of the Middle Eastern nations that are being dragged into this war. But it also represents an opportunity to remake the world in a way that rejects Western dominance. And if you've listened to the previous discussions that we've had on this show about international finance and imperialism in the context of climate change, and you know, side note, you can do that at any time through the various podcast platforms by going to linktree.com/theriftradio, then you know that that may be the only chance that we have at attaining some kind of ecological justice. Those thoughts were front of mind when I spoke to this week's guest, Dr. Danish Mustafa, professor of critical geography at King's College, London. Dr. Mustafa is a prolific researcher and publicly engaged scholar who has worked on water justice and climate response planning in Pakistan and elsewhere for several decades. That was mostly what I was expecting to speak with him about, but as you'll hear, our conversation ended up going in all kinds of directions. After the break, you'll hear us chat about imagining new ways of relating to the environment, thinking differently about environmental justice, and what the end of the West as we know it might mean for global ecological justice. You know, light Sunday fare. But first, programming on WEFT is presented in part by the Rose Bowl Tavern in downtown Urbana. The Rose Bowl Tavern features live music and The Rose Bowl Tavern features live music and entertainment 7 days a week. RoseBowlTavern.com is always up to date with details and information. The Rose Bowl Tavern in downtown Urbana. There's a jazz jam every Wednesday night. It's fun. You should come. Programming on WEFT is also brought to you in part by Elliott Counseling Group, who offers compassionate mental health care to individuals of all ages. Elliott Counseling Group serves Central Illinois with in-person and online sessions. More information is available at elliottcounselinggroup.com or by phone at 217-398-9066. And now, here's my conversation with Dr. Danish Mustafa. I'm joined now by Dr. Danish Mustafa, professor of geography at King's College, London. Dr. Mustafa, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
So just to kind of acquaint people with your field of study, could you describe your research and the general thrust of your work?
Well, I've been working in the field of water and environmental hazards and sort of climate for the past 30 years now. I was part of the team that wrote the first ever climate response strategy for Pakistan in 1992, believe it or not. And since then, I've been working in the field of water, environmental hazards, development, and climate, primarily.
Great. So I'm curious, you know, working in this field for as long as you have, you've, as you mentioned, you were involved in some of Pakistan's very first climate adaptation and mitigation plans as pertains to water, from water supply to irrigation to flood management. How do you or do you feel that things have changed over the years since you first became involved in that kind of work?
Sometimes I joke with my friends and colleagues in Pakistan that that country has religiously everything that I have ever advocated. Exactly the diametrically opposite has happened. So sometimes I feel like I should start saying things that I don't want to happen so that the opposite will happen. So unfortunately, I wish I could give you better tidings that the work has paid dividends. I think it has paid dividends in the sense that about 20 years ago, 20, 25 years ago, voices like mine with regard to climate, with regard to water conservation, with regard to thinking about ecology, etc., and taking a more political, ecological view of water, were not even acknowledged to exist. Were just like, oh, this is just noise, whatever, we don't even want to hear it. What is this gobbledygook? We are just not hearing this, la, 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 that sort of thing. So I'm happy to report at this stage, after 30 years of being in the field, that I am deeply disliked amongst the water practitioners and policy people in Pakistan, and I should say, perhaps in the global south as well. And that's progress to my mind. At least you're being heard, and they don't like what you have to say. And that is a lot better than being simply ignored and pretending that it doesn't exist. Now they definitely don't say that I don't exist, or the voices like mine do not exist, but they say they exist and it annoys the hell out of us. And that's great. It's progress.
And so when you say that, do you mean just in the sense that you are kind of a critical social scientist, that you're thinking about political problems, social problems? You know, I've found in my own work sometimes it's viewed as kind of an invasion into what people think should be a very technocratic and quantitative sort of thing. Is that what you experience, or is it kind of a different angle?
You see, are you talking within academia, or you're talking outside of academia?
Oh, both, really.
Well, when I started in academia, I was one of those curious sorts of instances. At least within geography, there was a very firewall kind of a situation between the natural sciences, physical geographers, and human geographers. And when I entered the field, I was trained in both. I was trained in physical geography, natural sciences, as well as in human geography. And so human-environment interactions, people say there's a physical geographers, there are human geographers, and there are human-environment geographers. And I should say that in 2000, when I graduated from University of Colorado, I was probably one of the first cohorts, if you will, that entered the field and answering to the description of human environment geographers. And equally, there was a comparable cohort coming out of Clark University and University of California, Berkeley. These were the two or three places where human environment relations kind of people were being trained. So at that time, the job situation, people just did not understand. If you do water, then you must be a hydrologist. You must be a modeler. You must be a natural science kind of a person. And the natural science people are like, yeah, well, so you are talking about vulnerability. You're talking about differential access. You're talking about gender-based access to water. You're talking about, you know, this raft of social factors that go into climate and water and environmental hazards. So that doesn't fit either in physical geography or really in human geography. In human geography, everyone was enthralled by urban geography primarily, you know, gentrification or development geography, rural development, those sorts of things. So a conversation around water, which brought both the science and the social science together, just did not exist. This was a very rudimentary kind of. So I just basically had to move out of the U.S. here in Britain, where there was a much greater concern with climate change as an intellectual idea. The U.S. academia was 4 or 5 years behind European academia in terms of embracing the climate agenda. So I found myself in London, and happily so, and now I'm very grateful that I'm there.
Got it. So you spoke a little bit about the, you know, being focused on the social determinants of, you know, water access and resilience in the face of climate change. Could you just talk a little bit more about that in practical terms? You know, what you have seen, the problems in a place like Pakistan, and how that compares to, you know, other places in the global south or elsewhere.
Well, let me step back a little bit. I am also anti the IPCC framing of climate change, right? And what I have found is that the whole conversation around environment is a very deeply Western-centric framing of climate and water. When you're talking about resilience, when you're talking about adaptation, when you're talking about mitigation, there's a whole toolbox that IPCC throws your way, and it basically says, oh, here you are, resilience means that biophysical conditions are going to change and you need to adjust to them, right? And I think that that is a very corrosive, and that is a very, that's almost like a cul-de-sac. There's a reason why we haven't gotten anywhere with climate. There's a reason why we're going in a particular direction, because the entire framing, and I would say the framing of IPCC, is incorrect. And the, instead, the debate has turned into a sort of vapid is one term that comes to mind, and the other one might be a self-destructive between climate deniers and the climate embracers, and some one people saying, oh, you know, we need to celebrate the Western-based climate science and accept that and move forward with doing what needs to be done. But what if one were to say that climate challenge, if you want to call it that, is fundamentally about how we have produced ourselves, collectively and individually. And in order to negotiate the challenge, and it is not just a biophysical challenge, it is a cultural challenge, it is a spiritual challenge, it's a political economic challenge. And in order for us to negotiate that, we have to produce ourselves differently. And that foundational redefinition and reproduction of us as social beings, as a collective and as individuals, is not something that either the IPCC or climate deniers or the climate enthusiasts or the environmental community in the global north is necessarily even understands. Like I often say to people that, you know, I'm very hostile towards environment. I don't like environment and environmentalists because it's steeped in a Western experience predicated upon a dichotomy between humans and the so-called physical environment out there. And the way people have lived with the non-human world has not been premised upon that dichotomy. So when one is talking about water quality, for example, water quality by itself is not a neat, cool, tidy, pious kind of a ambition. It is material to the health and well-being of the poorest of the poor and the most vulnerable of the people. So instead of talking about environmental quality as something separate from the human societies within which that they are embedded, we need to center concerns with equity, justice within the human sphere. And when we talk about equity and justice, it is virtually impossible to make any sort of a substantive, meaningful progress in that unless you take the non-human into account. So when you're talking about, oh, look at the forest and we need to protect the forest because it is kind of neat and there's like all sorts of cool biodiversity in there. Well, it's also someone's home, right? I mean, in South Asia, people don't have Sainsbury's or what are the big grocery stores in the United States that you go out there and shop. That's where the Sainsbury's is. That's the grocery store, right? And any sort of a diminishment in the quality is material to the health, well-being, and spiritual life even of the people who depend upon these. So I am not very sympathetic to this urban environmentalism or the Western-based, somehow we've appointed ourselves the rangers-in-chief of the conservators-in-chief of the non-human world and we're out there protecting it. You know, that's not the framing I'm very sympathetic.
Yeah, I mean, what I hear you describing is very much like a sort of political ecological framing, right? That's yeah. the basis of political ecology, as you know, as I understand it. And that does seem like something that gets under people's skin, because you start talking about broader transformation that feels very untenable to especially the people who are very invested in some of these global institutions, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or you know, the Green Bank, or all these multilateral governmental institutions that have been set up that are very ensconced in the sort of global capitalist international paradigm, right? So, yeah, I mean, I guess kind of coming back with that framing in mind to what you actually do think, you know, if we are to use the standard language, something like water security looks like in Pakistan or for anybody, you know, you're talking about, like, this is something that's very material to life and just people's existence, right? It's a fundamental need. Where do you start with that? How, you know, you have been participating in some of these, like, longtime, very established networks where that's probably not easy to navigate.
It is not easy to navigate. Partially, it is our fault as academics. We write incomprehensibly. We write in very opaque kind of journals using big words, and those journals are not accessible. And even when they are accessible, within the first paragraph, you fall asleep, right? As a non-specialist reading that stuff. So there is that problem. But I think that it is important for us to start asking very basic questions. For example, the other day, my university, King's College London, decided that it's going to do some virtue signaling to the rest of the city, and they're going to put up a little billboard outside the campus and get some quotes from the key researchers in the climate and water and environmental field, just as provocation. And the question I asked in there was that River Thames that goes through London, we've always, all the Londoners live on the River Thames. But what would it mean to live with the River Thames? Now, fact is that river communities in the global south live with the rivers. Rivers for them are sentient living things. And humans have always had, I mean, I teach this module in environmental thought, where it starts a narrative at 100,000 BC, before the Common Era. And I make the case that basically, in terms of hardware, in terms of neural density, a human being who lived about 50,000 years ago or 100,000 years ago had the exact same neural density as we do contemporaneously. If you could bring a child from there and give them the kind of modern education that is there, they would perform it at par as any one of us alive today. So for 90% of the time that we humans have been there, we've never made a distinction, like Paleolithic people or the indigenous people, about, what is it, 440 million indigenous people that live on this planet this day, despite our best efforts to cull them and eliminate them and destroy them and make fun of them. They do maintain that the world is alive. The non-human world is alive. People have conversations with the plants. I mean, ask any gardener. He has conversations with their plants. They're perfectly happy with that. Talk to people who live with the animals. And the animals are not just numbers, right? I mean, they're individuals with personalities, with an inner life, with a certain interiority, right? When I was growing up on a mountainside in Pakistani part of Kashmir, my grandmother just told stories about the mountain opposite us, and every single stone had a story behind it. Every grove of trees had a certain personality and a certain history and a certain depth to it. And of course, others would say, "Oh no, don't listen to your old wife's tales. These do not matter, and you know, don't worry about it." So it was only in the Neolithic period, when the sedentarization happened, that humans started making a distinction between the human and the non-human. It subsequently got further reinforced as we entered the modern period. So what I'm trying to say is that we literally, the modern educational system, particularly the Western educational system, it beats out of you any of that imagination, empathy, the sense of wonder about the world, and make you into what sadly we are at the moment. And then there's a huge sort of an explosion of research on human non-human relations. Someone is working on plant interiority, another one is talking about animals and their agency and their worldviews and their personalities, etc., etc. And I was very hostile to that agenda initially, because I said, you know, the entire cosmology, the mode of thinking, the mode of living, the West very successfully destroyed. And now they have found out that having destroyed that in the name of progress, modernity, science, objectivity, and everything else, now you want to go back and rediscover it. And it's just not working. People keep blackening computer screens and pages upon pages and reams upon reams of writing and all of that. It just doesn't work anymore. It needs a different imaginary, a different way of thinking. And it's inside of all of us. We're designed to think like that. As kids, we had loads of non-human friends. Everything was alive for us. So I think that at a certain level, we have to revisit precisely that, what is inside of us, and rediscover it.
Yeah, that kind of leads me to thinking about some of the more recent writing and research that you've done on this kind of cultural production around nature. You had a paper on the sort of relationship between Islam and culture and plant ecology in Pakistan, and then also co-authored a paper on the way that indigenous people in the southwestern US and in Nepal relate to water. And reading those two kind of back to back, it made me very curious, and I think this is kind of related to what you've just been saying. You know, how that cultural production interacts with like the modern state that we've built, in the sense that, you know, if you are a Muslim individual in Pakistan, then that's very much incorporated into the state of Pakistan. Whereas if you're a Diné in Arizona or a Musahar in Nepal, then the state's been working to more or less destroy you and your practices. And so those seem to me to be two very different ways of existing in relation to organized power. But they also have these similarities, right? It's at the end of the day, it is a culture that you are creating, and it is social reproduction that you are creating with and within the natural world. I'm just kind of curious on like what your thoughts are about, you know, you've talked a little bit about sort of this idea of, you know, we can't really go back, right? There isn't really a going back to do. But now that we have all these massive, powerful state organs that privilege, you know, certain groups of people in certain areas of the world, you know, what do you do about that?
Well, first of all, let's talk about the modern state, right? How's it going? We have a war in Iran, right? Thousands of people are dying. There's actually, for the first time in my life, there are serious conversations about it turning into a nuclear holocaust, right? There are people like presidents of the United States talking about a limited nuclear exchange. I recall Joe Biden was actually talking about in the context of the Ukraine war. I mean, these are conversations we thought we had left behind. We had left them back in the 1980s. In the 20th century, but here we are in the second, third decade of the 21st century, and those conversations are back. So it's an unmitigated disaster. It is an unmitigated disaster, the path that we've set up. Also, with regard to indigenous people, I mean, there was an active policy of genocide and physical elimination, and short of that, cultural elimination of the indigenous people. Millions upon millions were killed, right, during the process of European colonization of the Americas and Australia, and in the context of colonialization of the global south, where a lot of indigenous societies existed, India being a case in point, number of them, and trying to socialize them into a matrix of industriousness, habits of industry and parsimony, and a modern subject and a colonial subject, etc., etc. But they still exist. It's remarkable, right? That they're not doing very well. Obviously, the Dene people are not doing well. The Native Americans all over North America are not doing so well, and are they anywhere else? But they're there, right? And you don't suppose they see what's around them? I mean, living in a country like United States, they see the great cities of Phoenix, Arizona, and Salt Lake City, and Los Angeles, and all of those, and they say, no, thank you. We don't want no part of it. Indigenous people, Adivasis living in India, they see great cities like Delhi and Mumbai and Ahmedabad and say, no, thank you. We don't want any part of it, right? So, which speaks to the deep strength of that mode of thinking and its resilience to have persisted for literally a 10,000-year assault on that way of thinking since the Neolithic. So, right there is your cause for optimism, that there is something to the idea that it hasn't been stamped out of 10,000 years of a frontal assault on it, physical elimination. So that's good. Then the thing that we tend to undervalue and not talk about is capitalism. Now, capitalism, modern capitalism, is essentially, to my mind, a giant Ponzi scheme. Right? And every few years, the Ponzi scheme, someone calls it, that, oh, it's not going to work. And then the state steps in, much to the public anger, whereby the privatization of profit and socialization of the cost is the running paradigm. And within the scope of human existence, if one wants to be philosophical about it, it hasn't been around that long. And you have to let loose your imagination. I tell my students, I can teach you rationality, but I can't teach you imagination. That would be sort of antithetical to the whole idea of what we're trying to get at. But what we can do is, it's a job of critique, it is a job of deconstruction. And then whatever you're confronted with, whatever context that you find yourself operating in, you use, at least by breaking down those structures, you can imagine amazing things. You can imagine Star Wars, you can imagine spaceships, you can imagine aliens, you can imagine amazing things, but you can't imagine the end of capitalism. Right there, your everything fails. Oh, then what's going to happen after that? I don't know, man. Don't be freaking lazy. Figure it out for yourself. And I'm not going to tell you, oh, the model that works in United States is it should work in India. We should also work in Zimbabwe. That's nonsense. So the first step, to my mind, is, as I said, the value of deconstruction and the value of critique. My title is Professor in Critical Geography, and people say, you must be a curmudgeon, right? I mean, you're critical of everything. It's like, no, it's not about, well, it is partially about that, but it is more so about making the common sense uncommon sense. And common sense is the greatest enemy, if you will, of imagination. And so I am not very optimistic about the persistent resilience of the system that we take for granted that this is how it's always going to be. I think we are already seeing signs that the system has run its course. And I think that the world next year, this time, will be very different from what we have known. I used to think in my younger days that, yes, the West is going to decline. It's going to happen once I'm dead and buried. You know, it's a slow process. It happens. Now I suspect that it's probably going to happen in weeks or months. Oh, yes. I mean, we're literally, 400 years of Western hegemony, right? We knew it was going to end. it always ends, right? Everything comes to an end. But I never realized that I'll be alive thinking that, oh my God, I may actually get to see that within a matter of weeks and months. And if you really look at the foundations of the system, which is based upon mass production, mass consumption, financialization, and predatory extractivism of resources and biocarbons and what have you, it's just not sustainable. We know it's not sustainable. We kind of know that it is, notionally we know, but we just cannot allow ourselves, because of our socialization, to actually see, well, folks, it may actually do that. And we may actually be alive to see it, that it is not going to be a glacial pace. Can you say who will be the global hegemon and what's going to be the mode of production and what's going to happen a year from now? We can't. If you'd asked me this question 2 years ago, I would have said, yeah, of course, it's probably going to be the same. I'd still be spinning my yarn over here and no one would be paying attention. That's what it's going to be. And but now I suspect that things may actually change, things may actually collapse. But between the beginnings and the ends, no empire goes without causing horrible damage. I mean, when the Nazis went down they knew in 1943 the war was lost. But between 43 and 45, millions more died. I think the writing is on the wall. I think there are many people, thinkers around the world, who are just saying, well, how do we manage this such that millions don't have to die? But sounds like the empire is not going to let go without extracting that price of millions of lives destroyed before it's finally dead and buried.
I think what you're describing is what a lot of people on the left and in the organized left are kind of wondering about is how long is this going to take and what's it going to look like. I think that as you've said, the writing is very much on the wall, that whether it's 6 months from now, whether it's 50 years from now, the time of American hegemony specifically is pretty clearly coming to an end.
It's not going to be 50. And second of all, who cares about America? I'm talking about Western hegemony.
Sure.
I'm talking about, flags, right? How is American hegemony substantially different from European hegemony when there was...
I think earlier I would have said that, America was one of the particular driving forces over the last, half century, maybe. Now I'm not so sure.
You could say that, but you see, that's... America is not frightfully interesting to me. Living in America, I've lived in America for 17, 18 years, so I kind of know something about the country. But when you sort of think about it, extractivism, Americans didn't invent it, right? It's basically European migrants coming to the U.S. They had a wee bit of a genocidal impulse, and therefore millions were killed and replaced and destroyed, and a new society was built of mass production, mass consumption. Britain used to be the hegemon of the world, along with France, and then 1945 it came to be the United States, and it has its vassal states in the European continent. And between these two axes, basically the rest of the world has to follow a particular syllabus of how you're going to move forward, what constitutes development, what constitutes a good life, what constitutes, progress. And I think that there is a fundamental rupture unfolding in front of us. The left can ask the question, well, is it going to be 6 months or is it going to be 50 years? Well, it's been 400 years, so what's the hurry? But important issue is, people talk about, resilience in the context of climate change. I say patriarchy is very resilient. Do you want it to be resilient? Capitalism is very resilient. Do you want it to be resilient? When you're talking about resilience, what you're really talking about is, well, how do we change to negotiate climate change so we don't have to change? Fundamentally, that's the paradox that you're confronted with. And that's the whole IPCC paradox, which is why it's can't be solved.
That's the
climate developmental model, right? Is we want
exactly
to keep the same thing, but with solar panels or whatever, right?
It can't work.
Which, yeah,
It's not possible for it to work, right? And they say, oh, so do you want to give up all the modern amenities? Do you want to give up all of this, remote teleconferencing and radio stations and, the kind of things that you're doing? No one's calling for that. And I don't think that any one of us is appropriating that sort of authority to tell the whole society what it ought to be and what it ought to be. But I think that altogether new stories need to be told. I think that different ways of making sense of the world need to be highlighted. And then after that, I think that the society collectively amongst and within that, there'd be a voice, insignificant one, mine, another one, perhaps yours, and then a few others, will collectively chart a way forward. And I think that we are well on our way towards that. Isn't it remarkable? Mussolini marched on Rome in 1922. At the peak of the capitalism, the 19th century capital, fascism emerged, right? And in 2026, 22 through 26, we find ourselves exactly where we were in 1920s and 30s. That fascism has reared its head again. Surprise, surprise, we've been here before. We know the storyline, we know the plot, right? Except that in this particular instance, racism has come back, become fashionable, mainstream, if you will. And I just don't think that a conversation around climate change can be separated from conversations around geopolitics, racism, sexism, elitism, all of these things. I am optimistic that the kind of heartbreaking violence that we are seeing, the kind of perversities that we are witnessing, are a harbinger of a collapse. That collapse, I suspect, is going to have very negative consequences for me personally. My salary is not going to be worth anything. My pension is not going to be worth anything. Everything that I have known and built my life on is probably going to be undermined as a result of that. But what does it matter? Of the 8 billion people in the world, 7 billion people live unbearable lives. Lives of beyond the material deprivation of indignity, bare life, indignity of being alive. And I say that if a system that can give a affluent life to 1% or to 10% of the population, and complete misery for the 90% of the population has to go. And if the cost has to be my comfort and my well-being, then so be it. What does it matter? Who cares?
I think what I worry about in that context is that doesn't feel inevitable to me. There is so much entrenched power that, sure, we can have economic collapse. We've seen capitalists use that before. We've seen them leverage it for their own purposes. It's hard for me. And, when I was talking about, this might happen 6 months, might happen whatever. I think what I was getting at was, how do we get to a point where we're ready to fight against that? Because it's going to, that is my concern, particularly in the context of climate change, in the context of increasing natural disasters, in the context of, wanting to maintain society as it is. And, this sort of what we think of as maybe like eco-apartheid becoming, it already is a prerequisite, but I think it's going to become a much more obvious prerequisite, right? That's what's front of mind for me, is that I don't know that we're ready, particularly in this country, but,
I think, the United States, the kind of resource capture that the United States has been able to practice based upon its overwhelming military strength and dare I say, in the second half of the 20th century, its overwhelming soft power and cultural strength, right? When I was growing up in the 1980s, there was no question in my mind that I won't be listening to American music. There was no question in my mind that I won't be following American fashion and American food and American everything and go to the United States for higher education. I mean, that was a given at the time. Today, I don't find a young person, at least in South Asia, in Pakistan at least, who's particularly enthusiastic about going to the U.S. Everyone's like, no, sir, I'm not going there. Increasingly, people are saying, well, why even go to the West? You know, what's the big deal? I mean, is there a different laws of physics in the United States whereby they teach you different kind of engineering? Do you learn different anatomy? Do people have like three hearts or six lungs in the West that they teach you about them? I mean, it's the same deal, right? So I think that the genie of identity, pride, cultural difference has been let out. I was reading this book, I'm forgetting the name of it, I should be able to look it up. I think Janet Lahoud's book, World Before Western Hegemony. So she basically starts the narrative at 1250 and takes it through to 1350, and just before the Portuguese, as the first major European power, ushered on the scene. And one thing I found extremely attractive in there is that when the Portuguese showed up in the Indian Ocean, they were, you know, the African traders, and they were Indian traders, and they were Arab traders, and they were Persian traders, and everyone was just, you know, undertaking trade and commerce within the Indian Ocean basin. And the Portuguese pulled a fast one, and they started basically taking them out militarily and essentially establishing monopolies, which they just did not understand. Like, why would you do that? I mean, you make money, we make money. What's this all about that only you make money and no one else does? And before they got around to understanding what the rules of the game were, the Portuguese had pretty much subdued everyone. And that fundamentally has been the Western colonial model, right? There have been empires in the past, right? Empires have always, you know, the Indian Empire traded with the Chinese Empire, or the Southeast Asian Empire, or the Persian Empire, which traded with the Ottoman Empire, which traded with some other empire. People did that. But no one really thought, well, you know, I need to run it all. It's me. And then make up this gobbledygook about racism. Oh, why do we want it all? Because we're kind of white, and that's kind of good, and that's why we're superior, and therefore, you know, we deserve it. We're special people, right? That's the whole sort of mythology. I think that has been undermined. I just don't think that there is a material rupture, but there's a cultural rupture, right? In my childhood, there was no question that if you're going to not watch a local kind of a movie, you'd be watching an American movie. Hollywood ruled everything. Today, no one's watching American dramas. People are watching, you know, Turkish or Iranian or Indian or Bengali or other sorts of things. So technology itself has also ushered in a world where that unipolarity culturally or materially is not sustainable.
Let's hope so.
Well, yeah, I mean, one can say, one, yeah, sure. One can hope so, but it just seems to me that there's some cataclysmic changes happening, and it's rare for one to realize that you are actually living through them. And then when you turn around, everyone says, you see, someone like me, I grew up during the Cold War, right? I could not imagine that there would be no Soviet Union in the 80s. I remember I went to the Soviet Union with a college group when I came back, and this was April 1989, I think.
Oh, wow.
April 1989, that the chief Sovietologist of George Herbert Walker Bush, the first George Bush Sr., came to our college. Murray Fischbach was his name. And I just asked him a question in my class that, sir, it just seems to me that Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania haven't been there. I just don't see how they will continue to be with the Soviet Union going in. And he banged his hand on the table. And he said, there's no way in heaven or hell that the Baltic republics will ever be independent of Soviet Union. Of course, 1990, there was no Soviet Union. And then everyone turns around and says, oh, yeah, 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 I always thought that was going to happen. Mm. No one thought in 1990 that there was going to be no apartheid in South Africa. within weeks, it was gone. And it was, no, yeah, we thought that that was going to be the case. No one thought that in 1964, 65, you're going to have a Civil Rights Act. In 1963, you could not imagine it. And that racism would be a bad thing in the 1970s. And at least, you know, yeah, fine, 90% of people still are racist deep down, but they won't admit to it. And now they turn around and they admit to it. So
I was going
to
say.
You know, so things change. And as they change, it is really, really hard to see that all the certainties that we have grown up with are not going to be there. And therein there is cause for optimism when it comes to climate change. If there are different climate stories to be told. Like my supervisor, he wrote the first, four conceptual approaches to approaching climate change in the Indus Basin. And he said one approach is that you could go pick up the general circulation models and you tell people, oh, check this out. They are these really clever people with these big, gigantic computers, and the computers go round and round and round, and out comes this large beam of paper which says that you're all going to die in 50 years because the carbon is going to double in concentration in the atmosphere. You could do that. And that story sells to a certain segment of the population. But he said equally, you could think about climate change. If it is about changing behavior and it's about negotiating uncertainty, you could also think about historical precedents. One could say the partition of India in 1947 was a cataclysmic event comparable to the kinds of uncertainties and hazards that we are thinking of climate change. Maybe how societies negotiated those in the past, looking at the history, might give you some guides to. You could equally say that, there are contemporary water problems. I mean, you go to any urban stream in the global south, it's like a sewer, right? There is water scarcity. There are people dying of renal failure in southern Pakistan today because they're drinking brackish water, right? So unless you deal with those issues of here and now, how can you possibly expect to deal with the vulnerabilities of the future? So maybe climate is more of a presentist challenge. And the fourth one, he said, is a foundational political cultural reconstruction. From whichever religious position you come from or a spiritual tradition you come from, you can say, well, climate is happening because we are wicked. Climate is happening because we are cruel. We are greedy. We appropriate other people's rights. We exploit other people, other human beings. We are unjust, and that's why climate is happening. Now, the framing is moralistic, but the underlying message is true. Is it not about greed? So maybe, and obviously no prizes for guessing that I'm more sympathetic to the last one, that maybe it's precisely that foundational political cultural reconstruction wherein the salvation lies. Or you can go to the cops and drink some champagne and see the world, and I've decided I'm going to go to the COP 75 in the tropical island of Scotland. That's my plan. If this COP drama continues.
Oh boy, yeah, that's a whole other can of worms, which we probably just don't even have time for. But yeah, this has been a very, very interesting conversation that has gone in directions that I didn't expect it to. But I was glad to speak with you. And
you
I think it
should start expecting these sorts of tangents.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that is the thing. It's this is worth talking about. This is
exactly
worth talking and thinking through. I feel like I don't get the opportunity to do this much, especially being in that sort of more institutional climate world where we're thinking very presentist about, oh, how do we tweak this policy to?
Yeah.
And
try it. Doing it for 40 years,
right? And there is a certain amount of like intellectual awareness, I think, among like basically everyone, that there's a bit of rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic to it. But
yeah,
so it is. But yeah, I guess as we wrap this up here, is there anything that you would like to, I don't know, shout out in particular, work that you'd like to promote before everything goes to hell?
No, I think lately I'd just like to highlight for people. I mean, lately we've been trying to do some work with the high mountain communities in Baltistan in northern Pakistan, where there is a tradition of glacier marriages. In Balti cosmology, glaciers are living things. And you will find very highly educated people, Western educated people, and it's an article of faith that glaciers are living. because they're born, they grow, they move, and they die. And that's a living thing. And glaciers have genders, male glaciers and female glaciers. And then through elaborate rituals, they tend to marry glaciers, pomp and circumstance, and presumably, and they insist that they enhance, actually cultivate glaciers to enhance water supply. And we do not understand that. Scientifically, we don't understand it because almost all of the glaciological scientific knowledge that we have comes from study of Arctic glaciers or European glaciers, whereas or ice fields. Whereas the ice fields in high Himalayas tend to be very rocky and very different, and we don't understand those. And along with that, there's also a whole lot of conversation about the cultural origins of it. So I'm hoping to get into that as a continuation of my work with the indigenous people and plant varieties and others. To sort of learn that, first of all, if we can figure out the science of it, does it actually work? They say, they insist that it works. Mercifully, I'm alive at a time where we don't poo-poo indigenous knowledge by saying, oh, yeah, it's nonsense. If we don't understand it, it's not true. Like, if we don't understand it, it may very well be true. But maybe we need to learn a little bit more about it. And those are the sorts of smaller solutions for different kinds of ecologies and contexts which might be replicable.
Yeah, well, that sounds like really fascinating work. I'm excited to see where it goes. But for now, thank you for the great conversation.
Thank
I really appreciate
so
your time.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Roshan.
Yeah, again, Dr. Danish Mustafa, Professor of Critical Geography at King's College London. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Dr. Danish Mustafa, Professor of Critical Geography at King's College London. I want to thank him again for the great and thoughtful conversation and for sharing his expertise and his experience with me. It can be dangerously easy, and I'm speaking from experience here, to become cynical about the possibility of substantive change, especially when you work on climate issues. On which we've seen so little substantive progress. But I appreciated Dr. Mustafa's reminder that history can happen very quickly and often when we least expect it. And for those of us who are here in the West and are thinking about these issues, I do think it is incumbent on us to some extent to keep that revolutionary imagination alive. And I'm glad that there are people that are doing that. That's all I've got for you for today's show. As always, thank you so much for listening to The Rift on WEFT 90.1 FM Community Radio from Champaign, Illinois. The recording of this episode will be online later this evening, and you'll be able to access it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or the podcast aggregator of your choosing if you go to linktree.com/theriftradio. Up next on WEFT, it's On the Move with Herbert Burnett at the top of the hour. Until then, I'll be playing a little music for you. The next episode of The Rift will be on Sunday, April 19th. Until then, take care.
If you have a passion for bluegrass, local music, or reggae, then you are in luck because you are tuned to 90.1 FM WEFT. Our programming is created by our volunteer staff. At WEFT, it is elected committee members, enthusiastic air shifters, and dedicated members who decide what is unique and important to hear on the radio. WEFT is home to a wealth of knowledgeable hosts who bring you fascinating programs each week. Whether you're into gospel or jazz, Celtic jigs or Delta blues, salsa or hip-hop, we've got a show for you. If you have a passion for unique music and information, show it and help us continue to provide this service to you. Please go to weft.org and click on the Support WEFT link.
The Holy Spirit, that's us in the Holy Spirit. Begin to bless his name.